In this episode, we're talking to Ashley in regards to transport, particularly in Queensland, and different ways that we can design for experiences. So instead of just traditionally thinking about engineering solutions, how we can start to think about behavioural and experiences and how that actually makes the biggest difference without spending billions of dollars. Let's jump on in. Welcome to the Be Inspired podcast, and today we are meeting with Ashley and we're going to be talking about engineering alchemy. So Ashley and I actually met at an event. We had a great discussion and he actually put me onto a fantastic book, and from that he's also been doing quite a few talks on different ways that we can approach our approaches to transport and engineering. Ashley, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
So tell me a little bit, let's go into a little bit, tell us a bit about your background and your story to today.
I suppose my journey into engineering is a good place to start, and that was sort of towards the end of high school where I was looking at maths and physics and the engineering, typically engineering subjects, but also design and some of the more creative subjects, and studied engineering at university, but always it was the design portions of that degree that really motivated me. And then again in industry, as I moved, I'm obviously British and began my career in Bristol, but then moved to London, spent 13 years in London. And
so what engineering did you actually study at school?
It was actually called engineering and management at university, but it was all but one module of a mechanical engineering degree with a management credit bolted on. And then took a job working for a firm called the National Design Consultancy, which was a bit of a twist for what was basically an arm of the post office, doing a huge amount of survey work. But then got quite bored and moved to London with NDY, still with NDY, but began my NDY journey in the London office, and immediately started to work with some big design motivated clients that wanted the optimum and the best, and how do we achieve, and how do we do invisible services or high efficiency or testing the envelope each time. And that's when suddenly it's not just about big spreadsheets, it's actually about outcomes and results and improving the lives of people that use the spaces we create, and architects, structural engineers, services engineers. There's a whole design team that come together, a team of people collaborating and sharing ideas and challenging each other to make things taller or wider or reduce carbon or
stack up,
work better.
Absolutely.
And that, I think, is something really important that we often forget as engineers, is what are we actually trying to achieve and what's the best way of achieving it? And that's a question that I try and ask all involved in every project, often stepping outside the lines of building services, but looking at the bigger picture problem and how can we solve it more efficiently or more simply or more effectively.
And I think that's one of the interesting things, obviously, is that we wanted to discuss today. So whilst you might have, you know, be seen as the engineer on more of the technical side, it's actually how we're approaching the experience that people have. So we're both based in Queensland. You're originally, obviously, as you said, from the UK and been in London. And obviously then when you come to Queensland, it's a very, very different environment than it is in London. Want to explain a little bit about that, of how transport essentially works, particularly in a high density city that doesn't necessarily expand quite the kilometre spans that we might experience in cities like Melbourne or in, you know, Queensland, where we've got
actually the footprint of Brisbane, particularly if you start to include the fringe areas of heading towards the Sunshine Coast and the Gold Coast, that I think they're trying to rebrand as Greater Brisbane in advance of the Olympics to justify the game's name. But either way, the wider Greater Brisbane is actually quite a big city if you overlay it on some of the major.
Three and a half hours to go end-to-end to that if you want to.
Yeah, exactly. And the predominant mode of transport is still the private motor car for a lot of people. Yeah. The default for a lot of people is to get in the car and drive. And having come from London where, so my wife and I lived in the house, zone 5, South Croydon, traveling into the city. the thought of driving into central London is totally absurd. I literally never did it. Well, I would say never. Never did it once to pick up a television set from someone. Did I drive into central London and back again and sort of vowed never again. But I got rid of my car 6 months after I moved there and got another one 9 years later when Miranda was pregnant and we were
having kids.
Sort of having kids and thought, actually, we're going to need a car at this point. But for 9 years, we went without a car because the buses, the trains, the trams, the occasional Uber or London taxi are so much quicker and more efficient ways of getting around.
Well, I mean, I came from Melbourne and it was a massive change for me. I'd always lived in a Melbourne. We obviously have trams or light rail, as different states might call it. You know, the transport for bikes, which is my main mode of transport, which doesn't need to be too engineered except for the transport car, is, you know, it's just a lot easier. And when I moved to Queensland, this whole idea of I had to get in my car, I had to have a car, I was like, this is ridiculous. Let alone, obviously, when we have, you know, petrol prices going through the roof, a simple car in itself, by the time you pay for it, you pay for the fuel, you pay for the maintenance, you do all of that. You're talking thousands of dollars a year. But obviously it's about the spans of distance and things like that. So let's talk a little bit about that in regards to, you know, how we think about the experience that we're having versus the mode of transport necessarily, or how we approach that.
And I suppose there's nothing worse than sitting in traffic, except standing in the rain at a train platform waiting for a train to arrive that doesn't arrive. You know, the grass is always greener. Nothing's ever good. We all like a good grumble, don't we? But the train journey here, I commute by train every day, is the trains are air-conditioned. They're generally on time. I'm in the office almost every day, so say 10 journeys a week, I get a seat every morning and two or three of five evenings. I've got a phone, I've got an iPad, I can listen to a podcast, I can do a bit of work, catch up with some emails. It's my time when I'm traveling. If I'm driving, hopefully at least I've got my eyes on the road and I'm focusing on the driving. But I'm in an air-conditioned car, I don't have to share a seat with anybody, I can listen to whatever I like on the radio. If I want to pull over and get a sandwich or something, I've got that little bit of extra freedom. But then you find yourself sat in the traffic and you've got to pay for parking, and there's pluses and minuses. There's an issue with connectivity of public transport here. People the world over don't like to walk more than 10 minutes to a public transport stop. And in Queensland, a 10-minute walk is needing a shower when you get to the office if you're not careful, summer in particular.
That is true, right now at this time of the year.
So I've got a little fold-up bike and I ride to the station, shower when I get to the office. So that's me solved. But even if I walk to the station, I need to shower when I get to the office in summer. And a lot of people don't have that facility or don't want to take that option. So there's your first hurdle is train stations in Brisbane don't have sufficient population around them to justify the numbers catching the train. So if you look at people here living on 600-800 meter squared blocks, when you get out to the suburbs, nice wide roads, everything spread out, you don't get very many people within a 10-minute walk of a train station. Compare that with London, Paris, you know, Tokyo. Everybody's in high rises, everybody's packed in together, you get thousands and thousands of people in that same 10-minute walk radius. So that's why the buses have been more popular, that's why the metro buses have been taken up, and I think they've generally been considered quite a success. So there's definitely steps being taken in the right direction, but to get people out of their car and into the public transport, they need to improve the comfort.
The experience that people are having. So I think there's some first things that you have touched on is one, obviously, kilometres that we need to travel, and, you know, running down trains or light rail costs a lot of money, and I know friends who work in government say it just is a loss. You're always going to be a loss, because when I ask, well, why wouldn't we build more trains than that versus, and you can look at Victoria right now, building the infrastructure for the next 20 years to service areas that don't currently have that, but it's costing them billions of dollars and millions a year or a day in actually paying for that. what you've mentioned is the density is obviously one thing. So what we're talking about here is it stacking up. So the biggest thing is transport actually stacking up, because we don't have the density, we've got a lot more kilometres to travel. And so, you know, if we talk about that as the first thing, is obviously making economically viable. So then obviously the frequency. So if you're in London, you can generally get a train every 2 to 4 minutes.
Oh, yeah, the tubes are every, exactly that, 2, 3, 4 minutes. If it says 3 minutes, people are groaning that they've got to wait too long. If you get out of the tube zone, you're probably every 15 to 20 minutes for a train, but still very frequent.
That's right. And I mean, I must say, I actually made a conscious decision. I wanted to move and be near the coast, try that versus living in Brisbane. And we actually looked at that. We looked at the Sunshine Coast, where, you know, my mother lives and I'm very familiar with. It's a lot cheaper too. And that was, but the problem was I couldn't get a train. So if you wanted to live, you know, at the most northern point, you know, somewhere like Noosa, you would have to drive for 20, 25 minutes and you would get one train at 6:15, the Monday train, or otherwise you'd have to drive 40 minutes to Nambour to actually get the next train. To be able to do that. Now, obviously, the density is increasing. We know that Queensland's SEQ is increasing within the amount of people. Probably the biggest problem we now have is ability to build those houses that we need to do it. But, you know, when I looked at the Gold Coast in comparison, it literally was every 10 minutes during peak hour, and it's half an hour for the rest of the time. It's a fast rail. It's going to be able to do it very fast. I must say, as somebody who gets the train, you know, the train out to Umundi and Nambour or the Sunshine Coast are older trains. There are a lot. I've been commuting up there for years, coming from Brisbane to work and then going up to see my mother. It's very, very different versus the trains on the Gold Coast, and the experience is a lot newer. They're faster. You know, it is dense. Yeah. And I must say, the density of amount of people who are on at certain times, you know, you're not guaranteed. I'm at the end of the line, so I'm guaranteed a seat, but most of the time, three stops in, you're not necessarily guaranteed. So these are some of the things that, you know, when people talk about transport and thinking about that, it's interesting how that, you know, for me, that impacted a decision to want to move somewhere. Mm-hmm. But what we're talking about here is the decision of why people would choose to use their car versus to get on to public transport and do that. Whereas I would say if I looked at a Brisbane office, you know, in the last organisation I worked internally in, we would have most people would drive to work and park. Whereas in the Melbourne studio, nobody would park because it would cost a fortune, and most people, you know, 90% of people would be catching the train in or the tram in or riding their bike and doing things like that. And trip facilities are a massive thing as well that, you know, the Melbourne and Sydney market really base on for their commercial tenancies, and is obviously massively something that is designed for that as well. So talk to us then, if we've talked a little bit about the kind of infrastructure and considerations around that, you've touched on it slightly around the experience side. So as you said, people who are sitting on the tube might be, you know, sitting there going, oh, my God, it's 3 minutes versus 2 minutes. Let's talk about some of the learnings that came out of that book, Alchemy, and some of the learnings that you're applying into the design for transport and thinking about that.
I think, and I was thinking about this morning, actually, knowing that we had this conversation coming up, I don't know how long my train journey is. It's about half an hour. It might be 35 minutes. But the point of it is it doesn't matter for 5 more minutes. It's less than 40, you know, kind of who cares.
Yeah.
And that is an interesting point, is all I want when I get on the train is to sit down and be comfortable. And if it takes 30 minutes or 35 minutes, it really, it's just not the end of the world that people get so obsessed with here. And I've heard, I've been in nearly 2.5 years now in Brisbane, the question of, oh, you live all, I'm at Ferny Grove, which is the end of the line, you're all the way out there. Oh, well, it's 10 minutes on my bike, half an hour-ish on the train, and 5 minutes down to the office, I'm fine, it's less than an hour. Mm. Oh, I couldn't commute that far. Well, the train part, if it's working nicely, isn't a commute. It's, I'm listening to a podcast, I'm reading some emails, it's useful time that I get back.
Mm.
If I'm stood up like this and it's 30 degrees on the train, as it often is on the London Underground, okay, you don't want that journey lasting any more minutes than it has to. But if you make people more comfortable, all the other pressures of is it working, is it on time, is it not, they just kind of go away because you're not looking at the clock, because you're in a much more relaxed state. if everybody's hot and bothered and agitated before they even start, then you get a 2 minute delay. The fact that it's a delay at all, 1 minute, 10 minutes, doesn't matter. A delay is a real frustration. And that's where the frustration levels start to build. And of course, if you put lots of frustrated people together, that's when the friction really starts to increase and you get people getting upset with each other on the tube, which does happen.
So let's talk about that. We've obviously got two parts of the experience, or multiple touch points for the experience here. So we have the stations themselves, which, you know, you're involved in that design of doing so. Then we've got the trains, which are obviously the trains that are designed by the transport makers, or the, you know, those who are actually putting the trains together. What are some of the things that you're really advocating that we should be thinking about within our design of stations and other transport, like bus stops and things like that? What are some simple things that
I'd say it's the passenger. Every conversation within station design should be about the passenger, and that is all passengers. That's the commuter that knows exactly which crack tile on which platform he needs to stand so that the doors open exactly in front of him and he sits on the exact same seat every day. He's still a passenger that we need to understand his needs are met, but there's or her needs are met. We've also got the parent with a pushchair and two kids. We've got the guide dog and the visually impaired. We've got your wheelchair user. We've got those of a mindset that they don't catch the train very often, or they're of an older generation where it's all a bit scary anyway because they don't often go on the big adventure into the city. We need to make things as easy as possible for all of those people. A huge amount can be done with signage and visualizations and information. If you know, okay, I need to get to platform one and it's this way, that's a very comfortable situation of I need to catch a train into the city from, I don't know, and you're looking around and there's no notice boards. Mm-hmm. And that was one of my first observations when I got here. I was at Bray Park Station, which is on the list of stations to be upgraded, but all the same. The only way you can know what time your train is on, is coming at Bray Park Station, is to go and ask the staff behind the desk. It's the only station I've ever been to in the world that doesn't even have a clock. There is no way of knowing what time it is, what time your train is due, whether it's on time, what platform it's on, anything. Unless you go and ask, go and ring the button and press the button and ask behind the desk. And that to me was absurd. I'd never come across a station that didn't even have a clock. And
what did they think? Just hiding the clock means nobody will notice whether it's late or early? That's one approach.
Genuinely, that's been offered as a logic behind it. You know, in the days of steam engines, people used to set their watches at the train station because that was a way they could check times. The station clock is a feature of every station. But take that anxiety of, I dropped my mother-in-law. She lives up north in Childers. She comes down to visit, you know, every few months. I'll drop off at Roma Street. Brisbane's sort of busiest, central's the busiest, but Roma Street's probably the biggest station we've got. I know she's on platform 10. She catches the tilt train. It's always on platform 10. I drop her off and I'm in the little kiss and ride parking space, 2 minutes, not even supposed to get out the car. I walk in with her at the sort of back door of Roma Street and I'm looking up and down the platform. She's 20 minutes early, so loads of time. And I had to say to her, you're on this platform. She says, how do I know? Where does it say that? I said, it doesn't. And at the complete opposite end of the platform, there's a little kiosk. I said, look, wander up there, double check, but I promise you're in the right place. I have to go. The look on her face, pure panic. You can't leave. You can't go and ask the guy behind the desk over there. You're fine. This is the right place. And it was. But the only way of knowing that was because I knew that.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, I travel in from obviously, you know, one station down here, Varsity Lakes, all the way and I generally get off at Central. When I first started, I had to get off at Roma Street. And the other day I went into Roma Street, we saw each other at an event and I walked in. I was like, where the hell, which platform do I go to? This is ridiculous. I had to kind of walk backwards to find it. Went, oh, God, I'm a bit early. I've got, like, somehow I haven't timed this right. I thought I set my alarms to the right thing. And then I was like, oh, there's no Maccas, I can't get anything to eat, there's nowhere to fill up my water, there's nothing. Whereas I didn't quite realise, even though I wouldn't call necessarily Central Station the best station I've ever been to in my life, it's got an amount of facilities that are there. And I even think that surely in facilities, but also in rental return, it is actually quite smart to have things where people are sitting around. You know, if you provide a facility of a coffee, let alone the return of being able to get a return of the rent out of providing a spot there for somebody to be able to get coffee or to sell a newspaper or to do things like that. It's interesting, having traveled the world, how, you know, these simple things can actually make an enormous difference to somebody's life.
That's the general comfort piece, isn't it? Is you want to sit on the train in winter, particularly having a hot drink, it makes you more comfortable.
Or a cold one in summer. Well,
in cold one in summer. The signs all over the trains here: water only, no coffee, you know, nothing, no food, drink, water only.
Mm.
Yeah, well, why? So okay, somebody might spill it. They might. It happens. Guess what? London trains get coffee spilt on them. Okay, but they've also got bins for the empty cups. So when you finish your coffee, you can throw it in the bin if you didn't, you know, if you've got a paper cup. For the small aggravation of having a cleaner when the train gets to each end of the line, just do a quick walk up the train and make sure there's nothing that needs a quick mop. Very small cost, big picture, compared with the rental of those coffee kiosks, which can be incredibly lucrative.
Mm-hmm.
The comfort to the passenger, though, you don't have that slight, I don't want to say guilt, which is an exaggeration, but awareness that you're breaking the rules, which some people couldn't care less about, others find quite stressful, like to do the right thing and be compliant. No food or drink other than water. Well, why? If the goal of a transport system is to transport people, usually, sure, freight and luggage as well as, but generally people, let's make it as appealing as possible for people to be on the train. Yeah. Forbidding them from drinking even a coffee is a...
We're living in a state where they've declared it to be, you know, it's meant to be 50%, but it is now 50 cents for the transport currently. And it's quite funny, like my aunt came from WA and was like, oh, I'm just going to train, this is great, 50 cents, you know, this is great, the same thing. Yeah. I'm not going to pay $80, drive my car up, pay, you know, $40 in fuel minimum, park my car for $80 to $90 and the CBD have to find a car park, get into it, when I can just get on the train and get back for $1. So that was one of the ideas that was obviously put forward to get people onto the train system or public transport again. And the major thing with this is, and I think the part of this conversation is, we are talking about transport. People need to move around. We obviously, you know, Victoria and probably London had more of this, of where remote working and hybrid was. As I predicted a few years in, that would change back and we would want people more in the office as a majority, and you can see more and more companies kind of, you know, pushing that to be the way. So we have people transporting around and we have people needing to connect, right? Yeah. Whether it is for business or for other things or family or whatever it is. We, living in Queensland, I think I would say the M1, both to Noosa and to the Gold Coast, you do not want to be on that freeway. I refuse to drive because it's just, people are crazy.
I've had people around 3.5 hours from Malulupa, Maroochydore area to get to work.
Yeah.
Three and a half hours.
So, and it's just bumper to bumper the entire way. So the thing is that what we are talking about here is actually ways to incentivize people to be able to get onto public transport, to actually use the facilities there, because we don't have to then spend billions and billions and billions on road transport that constantly needs to be updated.
Well that's it. That update's an interesting point. Is do we want to head down the road of LA? We go 7 lanes in each direction, 8 lanes, or 9 lanes. Add another lane, add another. That isn't sustainable.
It doesn't actually improve. I think the studies have shown, you'll probably know more of this information, they've proven that for every lane that we add, it doesn't necessarily, it might make it free flow quicker for a bit longer, like for a first few years, but then it actually tightens up.
Yeah.
And I know the Gold Coast itself has been doing a lot of work on that, obviously with the light rail, you know, this conversation's around heavy rail as well, but looking at other ways that people get around. I mean, we now live in a state where, and I do this. I don't use my car anymore because I have an e-bike. If I want to get to the beach, I'm going to get on my e-bike. I drop my kids off. I just literally drop my kids off and I'd have to go over a bridge, get stuck. It was taking me 40, 45 minutes to drop my kids off, an hour round trip. And I saw this guy on an e-bike and I was like, I'm getting one of those. And like, now my trip is fantastic. My kids love it. It is that experience. But I think it's this larger part of understanding that as we get denser with our population, which is naturally going to happen, we know that, you know, we are starting for that very reason. You know, the zoning of where residential is allowed is actually zoned to consider what public transport is going to be and how we actually do connect. So we're going to have more people on public transport. We're going to have more people on the roads as more and more people move into the SEQ area, and it's going to obviously grow. And I mean, here we're talking about probably we're having this conversation more around urban, I would say, but the same exists for rural as well, which is probably more utilised for heavy transport than it is if we look at, you know, Queensland's situation in moving materials around the state. It's a lot cheaper way than moving it just on a truck. But at the end of the day, what we are talking about here is as our populations continue to grow, we need to take the learnings of cities like you have lived in and start to think about some of these very simple things that we don't have to spend billions of dollars on creating it, like the amount of money they must be spending on reducing the time to put a fast rail, and I put that in explanation marks because I don't think it was really a fast rail, from the Gold Coast to Melbourne to reduce 20 minutes when I sit on that train. Yes, getting home earlier does make a difference, but actually what makes a difference is either more frequency or having a nice trip.
I enjoy my back trip to Rory Sutherland and the Alchemy book that you referenced, as he talked about the London to Manchester high-speed line that was being built in the UK. And he said for the price of that line, you could, I'm trying to paraphrase now off the top of my head, but you could serve every passenger Chateau Patrice champagne, employing supermodels to act as waiters for the whole journey for cheaper than building this rail line. He said, and believe me, I wouldn't be sad if it took twice as long, provided I've got the champagne and supermodels. And that's where the mindset of the passenger has been forgotten. We'll get people there quicker. Why? Why is getting people there quicker the goal? If you're going from London to Manchester or Sydney to Melbourne or Sydney to Brisbane, I flew to Sydney for a meeting just before Christmas, and I've got to get an Uber from home to the airport because it was an early start. But then got to make sure I'm there at the airport early enough to drink a coffee and get through security and all of those things. Then got whatever it is, an hour or so in the air to get to Sydney. Then you get off at the other end and you add together all of these little elements of the journey, the actual flight time or the train time, making that bigger or smaller doesn't materially change the whole journey. It still takes you 3 hours or whatever it is.
I must say Sydney is a very interesting one on this. So Sydney is obviously just put in a metro line as well. So when I travel around, so I live on the Gold Coast, and one of these things that I often say is I'm actually strategically, when I looked to live here, I looked at the trains and I also looked at the flights as well. And so you can get a flight from here or in Brisbane, get a flight at 6 a.m. I can leave on the 6 a.m. flight or a 7 a.m. flight if I want. And I can be in Sydney even with daylight saving before 9. Without daylight saving, when we're all in the same time zone, I can be in the office by 8. So often for my Sydney clients, I've ended up being in the office before any of the staff have because I'm actually there earlier because the time is the connection is so easy. Yes, I drive and I park in there, so that makes it very easy and it doesn't cost much. But I go straight through, all the way on, straight onto a flight. I get off, I get straight into a train. I'm right in the CBD within no time. If I go to Melbourne, on the other hand, you're flying in. Yes, the time might be different, but then there is no transport. So even though I would still get the Sky Bus, again, because it's just as quick as getting an Uber and I've done it so many times, but I can get in and then get a train from anywhere from Southern Cross to the entire part or to get a tram anywhere. So as somebody who probably now uses the transport system to get around, and trust me, I get around everywhere because I like to know where people are. And that's also about the experience that somebody has when they work somewhere as well. You know, so I think that's one. And I will tell you, people will ultimately look at these things, you know, and maybe I'm a particular person who will look at, does it have an Uber trip or a shower when I get there? Can I ride my bike? Is that safe? That was one of my reasons for not moving to Brisbane, was because there wasn't enough safe bike passages that I was like, well, I might as well just get the train because I'm going to be catching a 40-minute train.
Bikeways here are, we're moving off the conversation a bit, but bikeways here are a shocker. They start and stop and end, and suddenly you think you're riding on a bikeway, and next of all, you're in two lanes of traffic with trucks bearing down on you at speed. They've been half done and they need to be properly done, but
yeah,
that's another piece. But you're absolutely right. You need to look at the whole picture with a transport. Yeah. It's from door to destination, looking at the components of the train journey or the flight time, or each bit is only a portion of it.
Yeah.
It's how smooth is the whole journey.
Yeah.
And again, going back to you've just said you're very familiar with that Skybus in Melbourne. If I'm not familiar with the Skybus, is it easy to find? Is it easy to catch? Is it easy to buy a ticket
for? Oh, it's shocking in comparison. Beginning a Skybus, there's no, for example, and we're talking about transport methods here, and it'll be interesting once Melbourne actually connects that and it'll go through Suntrain, but it's not the same. And obviously Sydney built that for the Olympics, and whilst people may say slightly different design city, that actually has a fundamental difference for people transporting to Sydney. And now the metro has the same. So I couldn't get somewhere and then I went there and then they're like, oh, the metro station is just here. The Bingaroo metro station, I was a bit like, wow, this is colossal and massive. But again, the experience was actually fantastic. Coming straight down into it, the doors, the safety doors were there, probably a lot more akin to something that we would get in, you know, the London and the Tube. And there was a lot more, you know, fantastic engineering and design put into that, both from a grandeur point of view, but also from a simple experience point of view. The experience is easy. They've designed shops all around those centres. So essentially, and again, we're not speaking for the businesses here, but essentially experience is great, but the commercial reality of how that has stacked up has got to be better in what we're seeing here as well. So what are some things sort of...
The commercial reality reflects the passenger numbers, and the two go very much hand in hand. I like to see that as a bit of a barometer of success, is when you spot a train station and it's sort of on its own, you know, not many people are using it. When it's got a cafe and there's a dry cleaner across the road and a small supermarket and a hairdresser and whatever else, the sort of little businesses that you need regularly and frequently when you live somewhere, when they start popping up all around the train station, you know there's a decent footfall through that train station. So yes, it's good, I'll catch the train because I can drop my dry cleaning off on the way and pick it up when I get home.
Absolutely. Or grab some shopping up on the way, you know.
But also the dry cleaner is there because there's enough people to warrant a dry cleaner. So the two become very much linked and self-generating. And that concerns me when you see empty shops near a train station or no shops near a train station, because the footfall obviously isn't there.
And I mean, so let's talk about that, bringing that back. What are some of the realities that people may not actually understand when we're talking about different experiences? And what are some of the learnings that you think that Queensland can apply in particular from either other states or from, you know, international experiences?
Thinking Queensland is a combination of many, many small things. And I don't think there's a magic bullet. There's no obvious major problem. This is wrong. I think there's an attitude thing where the trains are terrible, so I'm not going to catch them. Have you tried catching a train? No. Okay, get on it. It might be different to what you remember. Because as I say, they're generally on time. They're generally air conditioned. They're generally pretty comfortable. They're not bad. But finding which platform and which station and knowing the routes, and the TransLink app needs a bit of love. It's really not great compared with some of the competition. And go to, you know, see what City Mapper does around the world and some of these other apps. they could take some inspiration from that, that make the whole thing easier. I was talking to someone only lunchtime today, said his wife drives to work because she works out in the country. When asked to catch public transport, she says she feels like a tourist in her own city. She doesn't know how it works, doesn't know how to get there, doesn't know which buses go to where she needs to get to, doesn't really know how to find out, can't plan a journey. And that little level of anxiety, and anxiety is an overused word here. I don't mean that there's a state of panic, but it makes her a bit anxious and she's a bit uncomfortable. And as a species, we avoid discomfort. We don't actually go to comfort. We avoid discomfort. That's one of the human nature general approaches. That's how we're wired, that public transport makes her uncomfortable because she's not quite sure if she's on the right bus or train, or not quite sure where she has to get on or off. And until she's at the destination, she's not confident that she's going in the right direction. Moving all those pinch points, we improve the signage, we improve the app, we improve the booking system, we improve the announcements on the train. We have visual displays that say next stop is Fortitude Valley or whatever it is. And they're all done in such a way that they're easy to find, almost unavoidable signage. And I presented at the Transport Conference last year and gave some examples of Ferny Grove, which is a relatively new station. And I took pictures as I approached the station looking for signage. It's actually quite hard to see the signs in some of the pictures because they're all concealed behind pillars or they're up high at oblique angles that you can't find them. And then you get through the ticket barrier. There's only two platforms, one or two. A big sign that says this side or that side would be all you need. Next train. It's two-thirds the way along the platform. You need really good eyesight to read a sign that's four train carriages away. I certainly can't. You sort of end up walking up the middle of the platform and trying to guess which train looks busier. I'll try and get on this one and hope I'm in the right place. You need to take all those little mini pain points out. I was in Singapore over 20 years ago. They had a touchscreen booking system. Just press the station you want to go to, prints you a ticket, single or return. Bang, press. Yeah, it knows where you are now. You want to get to that one. It highlights the route on the screen for you.
Wow.
And print you a ticket, get off here. Great, sorted. 20 years ago. And I don't speak, my predominant language is English. I've got a little bit of French and a tiny bit of German, but not enough to say I speak anything other than English. But I don't find Brisbane trains any easier to catch than those in France.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. Isn't it? I think the thing is that as people who are probably catching public transport all of the time, we're quite familiar with it. But once you get your general route under control, it can be harder once you do that. I must say, I will be fair, I've actually found the Queensland Transport app quite easy. It annoys me because it brings up my train versus that, but it hasn't just updated. It's just gone through a recent update. Can't see what it is, but I'm sure there's things in the background that are doing that. But from a Melbourne system of where you can sit with a tram and it'll tell you how far away it is and when it's coming. And that's one of the things the Alchemy book talks about, is that if people don't know how long something is, if they know, okay, it's 3 minutes, now it's delayed by 2 minutes and it's due at this time, that just makes people relax versus sitting there going, where's the train, am I going to be late? It's not going to do that versus being able to give you a good indication of when you're going to get somewhere or what you're going to do. I think time is probably important for people who do want to get home and have, but what we're talking here is a slight difference in time of 5 to 10 minutes doesn't make as big a difference as the entire experience being nicer.
Correct.
Because we allocate that time. So in my head, I go, it takes me 2 hours door to door, but it's in the car for 15 minutes. I could probably ride now, but again, what am I going to do when I get there? Is there somewhere to shower? How's that going to look? And then sitting on the train, and people often say, why do you catch a train? I'm like, we've talked about the cost, but the big thing for me is I can sit and do work. Now, one of my problems is that whilst there is a Wi-Fi app, there isn't necessarily stable internet whilst on the train all of the time. And that's just a connection issue when you're going to more regional areas and going through things. And that includes on my phone with somebody like Telstra. Yeah. But it still allows me to do that or have time to be able to think and to do things. The seats are wide enough that I can kind of sit there and have enough space underneath to sit there and put your bag under and do that. And, you know, simple little things, for example, you know, I sort of think when we're talking about this of just even somewhere to put your coffee cup or your water bottle. Now, I know they say nothing but water on there. Good luck. I think most people, I get it, but I think most people are just going to do what they're going to do. I agree with you, but they have to discourage it, I'm sure, for people who don't do the right thing. But at the same time, just simple things that would actually make it quite easy for your commute. You think about those things on a train. My biggest problem is power, right? You look at that for something like Virgin. Now you get on a Virgin flight and you can plug your USB-C and your normal USB in and you can charge your phone while you're on that. Surely as an electrical device, as a train, that's not actually that hard to be able to provide that service, especially for longer train rides and things like that. But I'm sure this is all in the experience of when we're on the public transport. My experience is fine because most of the trains also have a toilet. So if you get stuck, you can, whilst it's a pain, you have to walk up. You also do have that ability to do that. Whereas other trains that I get on are very old and very run down and half of those things aren't there. Yeah. And you're like, oh, this isn't
very But very few easy. Cars have a toilet. And if the train journey is of a similar length, you're probably slightly absolutely. Better off.
So, look, I mean, we've talked about a few things in here in the entire experience, and to summarise where our discussion has gone, we've talked about one of the economics around making transport stack up within density and the amount and what that looks like within also enabling. There's two factors that you talked about of the other supporting infrastructure, so shops and things that are around those stations. I think that's something that, you know, you've talked about whether they're popular or not. I think it's also a factor of what is around the station, building infrastructure when designing stations, building infrastructure to actually create it as a community, whether it is that you've got the 7-Eleven or some convenience store that's built in there, somebody get you chewing gum and a chocolate or the newspaper if you are. And we can take Roma Street versus Central as a very good example of two very different experiences. Can't find anything, don't know when anything is, can't get any resources, very hard to find which platform you're on, very long, very overwhelming, versus Central having lots of infrastructure around it, both coming to the station and in the station, good signage as you go through, well air conditioned, you know, nice platforms, facilities like water taps and things like that, toilets on the platforms. Simple things like that do make a difference. Now, I'm not talking accessibility here. I think there's obviously an enormous amount of work that can be done within our accessibility design, especially in Queensland. I would say that it's for most of the stations that I've been at, not a primary consideration.
No, but I think on that one, the accessibility upgrades are some of the most expensive to implement. And what a lifting the height of a whole platform by 100 mil can be vastly expensive. You're almost talking about rebuilding stations sometimes as you've got minimum ceiling heights and suddenly you're changing escalator levels and all sorts of things. But the staff are usually super friendly and super helpful. That there are two wheelchair users that catch my train and another woman with accessibility needs that requires assistance, and the staff are patient and available and friendly, right. And I think that's probably as much as we can do with the existing infrastructure, looking at somewhere like Central compared with the brand new stations down on Cross River Rail or the Gold Coast Light Rail, etc. They, I'm hoping at least, have got the platform levels right that they don't have these same issues. One of the things that we look at in design is the feeling of safety and security. So we're talking about station design. And I was actually assaulted by a tradie a couple of months after I got here on a train about 7:30, 8 o'clock, something like that in the evening. He'd had far too much to drink and I was fine afterwards, but it was a relatively intimidating moment at least. And I said to several people the next day in work, oh, you know, this has happened. We don't generally get the trains after dark here. I went, what? Trains aren't safe after dark. Absolutely nonsense. Never heard anything like it. how can you know the dark doesn't make trains unsafe. the people or lack of people on them, actually the more people on them, the safer you are. There's a safety in numbers that needs to be got through. But the even some of the Queensland Rail design guides that talk about lighting, I've got a quote here I'll find for you. You might need to give me a second to find it. But the where are we? Public Transport Infrastructure Manual from 2015 says lighting should ensure a safe, comfortable and functional environment. And if you go to most of our stations after dark, I think they're anything but safe, comfortable environments. And what can be done relatively inexpensively with lighting and finishes, nice, light, bright colours that lift the feeling of the place, are slightly more difficult to clean and therefore come with a cleaning cost that gets frowned upon. But again, people will avoid public transport if they feel anxious because it's dark and there's shadowy corners and there's someone at the far end of the platform that they don't like the look of. I'm going to get the car tomorrow. So you lose two journeys then, obviously, because if someone's coming in by car, they're going home by car.
Mm.
And if they know that through the winter, they're generally going to be coming home in the dark, you might lose someone's train commute for the whole winter because they don't feel safe. And that's probably the number one human instinct, is to avoid places or situations that cause you to feel unsafe.
So, I mean, let's talk about that quickly. So lighting's one solution. I would imagine other things like cameras or other solutions that could
Cameras are a solution, but who's watching them and what happens to them? And the guy, the incident that I was involved in, was definitely caught on camera. Nothing happened to him. He got off the train and cleared, you know, walked away. That was the end of that. And, you know, they're not going to launch a police search team with dogs and helicopters for a minor incident that happened, you know, on a train. So the cameras are useful to a point, but having...
I would say, being on the Gold Coast train, I know that people, so for example, if people aren't stepping through, they've obviously got cameras through, that it's... There must be some. I mean, we're living in a world of AI. Surely there is something that, you know, incidents can be built into the technology to identify when there is either on stations or there is in trains when there is something that isn't. But that's confrontation, right?
Yeah.
Then there's obviously, you know, potential of theft. And you're being a female. I mean, I catch the train at 11 o'clock at night. Right, if I'm in an event and I might not get home till 12:30 by the time, and that's coming from generally the city and then coming all the way on a train line that has about 45 or 20 something stops, right? And then you get here and you're the last one on, you know, the lighting, obviously Advarsity is, you know, we're talking a newer station, is quite well designed, and, you know, but once you get out to go to the parking, the lighting's probably a bit questionable, right? There are security cameras and things like that around. Is there other things that can be done within the design of stations or upgrading of stations that are simple like that, that can be engineered in?
I think probably we've touched the big two of lighting and CCTV. I think one you mentioned earlier is the power to charge phones, etc. If you've got at that time of night, there's a chance you've run out of phone signal, that if there's an opportunity, or phone battery rather, if there's an opportunity that you've got your phone still working, that's going to make a small difference. Yeah. Having staff in and around stations, even one member of staff, increases the feeling of safety. And back to designing for people, we're designing for feelings. The truth is way less important than how people feel. What people believe to be true is their version of the truth. Mm. So if having a really well-lit station with a tannoy system that you come out of that station and it feels super well-lit and you're comfortable, there's no shadowy corners for people to hide as you walk back to your car, that's going to make you feel vastly more comfortable than getting out of a well-lit station and suddenly this is all a bit spooky as I do the 50-meter trek through the car park, which is a relatively empty car park because it's late at night. and you're on your own? And do you feel like you're on your own if it's dark compared with if it's light and you can see a CCTV camera? And if the CCTV camera moves and tracks you across the car park, whether somebody's watching it or not, that might just make you know that you're being watched and someone's looking out for you. And that's the thing that we need to get to. And say each mini decision through the design of these stations is about what does the passenger feel here? What situation have we created or avoided by taking this action or that action? And that, I think, is the key overwhelming point to the whole piece, really.
It's quite funny. We just talked about the trains and charging, right? Like, this, that is the thing. If you're doing a full day and, you know, you're using your phone for other things, we are lucky we do have a device in our pockets, but the device often runs out. Then I think the ultimate next thing is if whether you can have those types of things where it is an automatic charging station or something, right, where you can sort of stand or sit. If you're sitting at, if I think about Central, I think about Roma Street, you're sitting there and you know, if I could be able to plug in, or, you know, most of people have now Wi-Fi or
whatever. Wireless, yeah.
Wireless charging of their phones, a little bit like when you go to the hospitals. Generally, there is some way you might be able to put your phone in. I can understand that would be not ideal necessarily because you're trying to get it out while the train's coming. But in that same way, some of those little things do make potentially a difference. Now, I'm sure there's lots of studies that have been done on these things, but I do agree with you as somebody who does walk. If I see a CCTV and I've got my phone in my hand and I know I can call somebody, that feels a lot safer than if I'm simply, you know, by myself and I don't have that and it's late at night. That is going to be a concern. Now, the hard thing is I'm talking about traveling to a car, right? Whereas most people will be also traveling outside of that and then going up streets and then, you know, walking all the way home or jumping on their bike if they've been able to ride and park and then continue to do that. Like, for example, on that, I don't actually see very many ride and park options within stations where you can ride to, particularly in, you know, Brisbane or along, where you can ride and park your bike safely. I don't think there's probably enough. And that's where one of those options come in, particularly with e-bikes and e-scooters. You put an e-bike or an e-scooter in a train and it takes up an enormous amount of room. It's also very awkward for that person. They can't sit down for that entire ride. So again, we are actually stopping people because we've, you know, it's fine to be able to have it, particularly if you're talking about trains, it's on a set loop, but to actually even be able to get to that point of transport can be difficult itself and the same. Is that some things that are being considered within trains and bus terminals?
E-bikes are a political one because of the perceived fire risk and the batteries.
Of certainly course. Not quite perceived, true.
Well, that's large. Yeah, I mean, an e-bike is more likely to catch fire than a regular bike, but an electric car versus a petrol car is I think some of the stats there are less would cause the belief that it's a bit sensationalist, but the fact of it is if an electric bike catches fire, there's a very hot, very intense fire very quickly. They're banned from all London transport. And I think a lot of the trains in Europe as well, electric bikes and scooters are banned for that reason.
I understand
They're not banned in Brisbane at the minute. Whether that comes in or not is something I'm looking out for in the news as a piece of interest. My bike's not electric, so it won't affect me, but it is. There's a chance that they bring it in here to reduce that risk of fire.
But if you're putting something in an area that doesn't have, that is sort of close enough but excluded a zone, look, you think about it, if you take up three car parks, you could probably fit in how many bikes, whether it's electric or push bike.
Massive number. Yeah. But then there's the security of the bike. And I know that we have the lockable sheds and their PIN code entry and the CCTV and all the rest of it, but people get very sentimentally attached to their bikes. Probably more so than people get to their cars on average.
I've got 10 bikes, so I've got quite a few, but I wouldn't be taking my best bike if I was living in the state.
There you are. But you might buy a sort of old tired bike for your commute and just leave it chained up and hope. And if it's in a locked in enclosure with a PIN code that you've had to pay a monthly subscription to get the PIN code, you probably feel okay. But like you say, you wouldn't leave your best bike. I haven't got 10 bikes, and I wouldn't be leaving either of mine in a in a cycle shed. So,
and why is that? Because you're worried.
Well, again, the rumor, the news that people gave me was don't trust the lockups at stations. I know, you know, so many stories of, oh, and I know someone who had their bike nicked, and horror stories of, yeah, it might be allegedly secure, but someone will rent a code for the month and just nick, go in there with a little battery angle grinder and nick all the bikes in there and put them in a van and away they go. That you,
interesting.
Knowing that a crime has been committed and knowing that they're on camera is one thing, but you still don't get your bike back. So I wouldn't take that chance. And I'm quite an advocate of public transport, as you realise, but this is back to the perception of, is my bike safe in that shed? Probably. Yeah. Am I going to chance it? No. Therefore, I don't feel safe enough to use it. Therefore, it's unusable for me. And I think that's a great little example of someone having a reason not to do a thing or not to use the public transport facility because of a personal belief. Doesn't mean it's true, but it would be enough to prevent me from using it.
But again, in design, talking about design, these are types of things. So in essence, what we're talking about is overcoming the barriers, understanding the behavior, tracking the journey that everybody has, not just on the train, but into the station or to the station itself, from the station, the experience in the station, in the train itself, or in buses. So we have just talked a lot about trains, but buses are exactly the same. And obviously for somewhere like Queensland, half of Brisbane is very, very undulating. I think you were even saying, you know, to get the train to go to the Sunshine Coast, you have to manoeuvre up some enormous hills and things like that too.
Yeah, the general topography of Brisbane is not ideal for train travel in a lot of areas, and that's why they've got the buses, which are generally successful. I think improving bus travel by reducing car lanes and making bus only lanes, even if they're certain times of the day, we've got our T2 for car shares, but make them bus only. You know, between, we're in Edward Street in the CBD, between here and Fortitude Valley is four lanes each way on the road. The main M25 that orbits London is four lanes each way. You know, the Bruce Highway is three lanes each way. Well, if we've got four lanes each way between here and the valley, that there's no need for that at all. You could easily lose one, if not two, of those lanes and make them bikes and cycles. And initially you'd create gridlock until people sitting in their cars are watching buses coming past them every 5 minutes thinking, do you know what, I might give that a go tomorrow. That feels like a better solution to me than sitting here for hours in gridlock traffic. And might be about creating some pain to solve a bigger picture problem, because with the population growth that you mentioned, I think the stat I heard recently was a 50% growth in population in Greater Brisbane in the next 25 years. So they have to do something about the roads, because they cannot make most of the roads here wider without knocking down the buildings on the sides of them. So therefore,
well, it's quite interesting, having lived in Melbourne for 20 years, and I don't know how you found London as well, but, you know, as a bike rider and lived in the inner suburbs, I went from being unsafe on your bike and not being able to having a dedicated bike lane pretty much all the way through in multiple ways. And so you would find, you know, suburbs like Fairfield and things like that that were a bit further and might have a train. Most people were, you know, things like Thornbury and stuff, people were just commuting in because there was a pathway that was actually created. So creating bike lanes is actually one of the best. And as I said, it was the entire decision of why, you know, that wanting to be near the beach was, well, I'm not going to be able to ride to work, and that's a pleasure for me. Mm-hmm. That's going to reduce. It's going to change the way that I live my life. Why would I put myself in? I literally rode into the Fortitude Valley and was like, I'm going to get killed on this road. There is no connectors. There's nothing. This is not going to work.
No, it's terrible. I don't like it at all.
Yeah, there might be some good connections through, but I mean, there's very limited bike paths and bike ways, pathways in. So people have no options but to necessarily get in their car or to take public transport that may not connect when we are talking about in connectivity. I mean, the Gold Coast City Plan has a lot more on that. and what it is doing and thinking about that connection, particularly as you've got a lot more distance to travel. You know, for those listeners, the Gold Coast is a little bit like Chile. Everything in Queensland sort of runs in SEQ, kind of runs 5 kilometres in from the beach and the coast, and then that's it. So it's very, very long, but it's not very wide. And so it means that if you're on the Gold Coast and you're on the southern end like I am, it's a 45, 50-minute drive in back-to-back traffic to get to the top end, when realistically, if there was bike lanes and things like that connected, you would find. And there's been some new things put in with the new M1, but it's actually that connection that's the most important thing, and you will find more and more people doing it. So, all right, actually, we've covered a bit of ground, not necessarily everything that we were thinking, but in a general discussion. Is there anything that we haven't covered that you wanted to sort of mention?
I don't know that there is. I might just skim back through the thoughts there that we had, and in fact, I think we have covered a lot of it. I think you'd say the point, probably the start and end point, is when we're designing, we need to design for the passenger. We need to think about the user, and whether that's a train station or a stadium or a shopping centre, there's a lot of people with a need. Some catch a journey, some watch a game of sports, and some make a purchase in that example. But a large crowd of people coming together, they've got the need for food and water and a toilet facility and information and Wi-Fi, and all of these things are very common to anywhere that significant groups of people gather. And then these people are going to gather. We're a pack animal. We're not stronger than lions or faster than woolly mammoths or whatever since forever. The reason that we are the species of animal that has gone so far and away above anything else in terms of the use of tools and facilities and creation is because we use our collective brains. And I'm like you, I don't really believe in working from home, generally speaking. If there's a need, I'll work from home for a day or two. Some people have particular reasons why they need to work from home on particular occasions. I'm absolutely okay with that. But generally speaking, we come together and interact as a group far more successfully than we do as a collection of individuals. And therefore, we need devices to move people around. And for that to be efficient, we need to think about those people that we're moving around. And we can do so collectively. We mustn't, as designers, put on our blinkers and look at our portion of the puzzle and think we've solved it, when actually we can take those blinkers off and sit at a round table and discuss collectively, what are we actually trying to achieve? Is there a better way of achieving this solution?
At the end of the day, a government needs to invest in its transport to make the city more livable or to move. And if we are talking about having people come to Queensland to come to enjoy our sports and things, what they're going to remember is how long or what that experience was, right?
Absolutely.
They're going to go away with that. You know, if you walked into Sydney and you could get the train from here to there and it was easy, you can do the same in Brisbane, by the way. Same line I'm on. Maybe that's why it's so good. But in essence, it's kind of just realise that. In essence, that's what we need to be keeping in mind. But in building something for this, for an Olympics, you know, people say that the infrastructure we're building, as you said, is we are growing the population. This is the place to be, but people won't want to be here if they can't get around.
No.
And I think that's one of the things that Queensland doesn't quite understand or hasn't had that, because it hasn't had the density of population to be able to move people around. And if we don't move that population around or make it accessible, so, for example, where I live, I will not get on the M1 after 11 a.m. on a Friday. I will tell people, not my parents and everything, I tell travel at either 5 a.m. in the morning or late at night, because you can't actually get around. So what that's going to do, it's actually going to start to crush the economy or the growth or where people actually will travel or live, because they can't actually get around. That experience is too difficult or takes too long or precludes. So we're going to go from this, oh, Brisbane's great, you can get around, you can drive everywhere in 10 to 15 minutes, to a gridlock. You know, I've got team members who live overseas, and their cities that literally, if there's no traffic, it takes them an hour, it's going to take them 5 hours to go somewhere. And this is the types of density and the problems that we face, as you said, like LA. If you only invest in motor transport, the studies show that's only going to get worse. So we need to look at the way that we're moving people, but we need to also think about that as the return on investment of what we're getting per dollar in the infrastructure for life versus the experiences that we built. Is it a lot cheaper to put in a new system where you've got CCTV and, you know, design that slightly around or put new signs up versus spending billions of dollars upgrading and doing things? Can it be done in other ways? And I think that, you know, in the future of technology, there's lots of things that we can use. But as we've spoken about, the experience is actually one of the things that matters the most. What we do for an experience of leaving our house to getting to work, that's what defines that experience versus having something that has to be brilliantly engineered, but is it actually engineered for the end user?
Yeah, I think you've wrapped it up pretty nicely there.
Excellent. Ashley, is there anything else? Now, we always like to ask people, you know, if there's a book or a podcast or somebody, for example, that you find of quite interest that you think others would benefit from listening or reading.
I think we've mentioned it already, but Alchemy by Rory Sutherland, I think, makes you think very differently about a lot of these problems. And collectively, if we start thinking about our problems differently, we might come up with some different solutions to those that have been tabled already. Yeah. So I would put that one out there.
Absolutely. Brilliant. All right, Ashley, thank you so much for all of your time, and we appreciate your insights, and I certainly look forward to what transport looks like, particularly in an emerging and growing state like Queensland over the next 5 to 10 years.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
What an in-depth and insightful conversation in regards to both the technical and the other behavioural issues we need to be thinking about when we're designing for transport, both in a Queensland context and both in international. Brisbane and Queensland are going to be experiencing a massive influx in population and people coming in, and there are different approaches that we can do without spending billions that can make a difference to the day-to-day experiences of those who live in the city, but also who will be visiting the city for the Olympics in the years to come.